Okay, so let's get started. Who uses JUnit? It would have been disturbing to see no one raise their hand. Who uses JUnit 4? Cool. Who's still stuck in JUnit 3? You being forced at gunpoint or? Fair enough, using an old framework. So today we're going to talk about JUnit. We're going to talk about some advanced techniques using JUnit. They're not hard, but you just have to know that they're there. And if you do know that they're there and you know how to use them, you can get a lot of leverage out of your tests and take them a long way further. This is one of my pet topics, so I sometimes get carried away, just start jumping up and down and screaming if I go on a tangent too far. So let's get started. My name's John Smart. I do a lot of consulting work in this area, the automated testing area, build frameworks. I write books, written a book and a half. I do a lot of talking, obviously. A lot of work in the agile space. We will get there eventually. Yeah. Doesn't matter. You'll see it on the slides. So I do a lot of work in the agile space, mostly in the Grail or Java, Groovy, Grails area. A lot of work in the automated tested space, TDD, behavior-driven development, BDD, that sort of area. So you'll see a little bit of that coming through in the presentation. What are we going to look at today? We're going to look at some techniques that will make your tests better. We're going to start off with some really complicated stuff like how to name your tests. No, seriously, that is how to name your test is a way that that is a technique that can revolutionize your testing practices. Seriously, we'll see. Well, look, who uses Humcrest? A couple of people using Humcrest. Once you've seen Humcrest, that's another thing that revolutionizes your testing practices. You can't live without it. Once you've written a Humcrest assert, you can't live without them. They are very addictive and very, very powerful. We'll look at some things that have come out in JUnit 4.7, like rules. We'll look at how to run tests in parallel. That's always fun. Look at also, towards the end, we'll try and fit in a little bit of Makita. Who uses a mocking framework? Cool. Who does TDD? Not enough. I should do a TDD talk too. Who uses Makita? Okay, so those of you who don't use Makita, I'll take you through a few examples to show you why Makita is awesomely cool and why you should use it. Okay, if you're using JUnit, this should be fairly familiar. A JUnit, four tests. Test is basically a random class. You start off with any old class. The cool thing about a JUnit test is that you can call it anything you want. So in this case, you can read it. What have I called this test? When you create a cell. This is an example that I got from a coding dojo that I did a few months back based on the old Game of Life from the 70s. If you don't know what the Game of Life is, it doesn't matter. Who knows what the Game of Life is? About half. Okay. That's a mathematical simulation. But for the purposes of this talk, it doesn't really matter. You can just look at the names of the tests and try and figure out what's going on. It's not really that important. The point is we're naming our tests in any way we want. It gives you a lot more range, a lot more flexibility in what you can do. It's all annotation-based, so I'm assuming this is nothing new. So you say at test rather than test whatever. You still see test whatever from time to time, but it's more old habits than anything else. And you can also use annotations for metadata. Annotations go beyond just saying a test is a test, but you can say other things about your tests. Okay, hands up, everyone for whom this is totally familiar and obvious. Great. So that's a basic JUnit test. Nothing fancy. JUnit 4 is not particularly complicated in itself. The interesting things are how you use it. Now, I said that you can revolutionize your testing practices just by changing the way you name your tests. Now, tests are more than just bits of code that exercise your application. If you write your tests correctly, they can act as working examples, working documentation of your code. If you have a comprehensive set of unit tests that are well written, you can go in and tell a developer, hey, I want you to fix this. Here's the list of tests. Here's the test cases that explain how this bit of code works. Go and add this to it. That works really nicely if you name your tests right. So naming is really important. It also helps you express what you're actually trying to do when you write a test. So this is sort of in the test-driven development, behavior-driven development approach. Your tests express the idea, the behavior that your application is actually doing. So what I often say is, I don't actually unit test my classes. No, I don't write unit tests for my classes. I just test the behavior of my application. Even at a low level, I test the behavior of my API. And the classes get tested as a side effect of the fact that I am writing tests that express how I want to manipulate my API. So you've got an API, say a bank account. You want to do a transfer. You're not going to say test transfer or test withdrawal. You're going to say, when the client wants to withdraw some money, this should happen. That's what you're trying to test. You don't care how it happens. You want to test what it actually does. Is this familiar to people? Is this a strange alien concept? Who is familiar with this basic idea of testing the behavior as opposed to testing the methods of a class? Few people? Quite a lot, actually. Yeah, good. Almost a third or half, maybe. That was good. So this is a really fundamentally different way of writing your tests, and it changes the way your tests behave. It changes what your tests bring to the table. You're no longer just testing the implementation of your code, of your classes. You are testing what your application does and what your application is meant to do as opposed to how your application does it. And that's huge, because it means that if your implementation changes, then your tests won't necessarily change if the behavior of your application hasn't changed. If you're testing an API that does a sort, for example, you write a test that expresses the input and the expected output, you're not going to bother about testing how it actually does the sort, what algorithm it uses. You're just worried about the outcome. So you apply that same approach across the board, and it revolutionizes the way you write your tests. So I've got a few tips on writing tests, on naming tests. It's quite simple. So I came up with 5 relatively arbitrary rules that you can use to just keep in mind how you should be writing your tests, how you should be naming your tests. So the first one is, don't do this. Don't use the word test. So the word test, get rid of it. That's the easiest approach. Ban the word test in your tests. Sounds a bit weird. So you don't want the word test. The word test means that you are thinking about the methods in your API. You don't want to test the methods in your API. You want to test what your API is trying to achieve. You want to test use cases of your APIs. So this can be applied at a high functional level, but here I'm talking about unit tests. Making that very clear, I am talking about low-level unit tests here. So you are writing functional tests for an individual class. It's still functional tests. So you won't be testing private methods. If you're not confident that your private methods behave correctly, maybe they're doing too much. Maybe it should be extracted into a separate class that needs to be separately tested with its own API and its own behavior that needs testing. So by banning the word test, you can get away from that habit of, okay, I've got these methods that need testing. Here, I'm going to write a test for each method. Because when you're testing the behavior, You might be testing us the same method many times with different combinations and different expectations. And you're expressing what you think the outcome should be. So rather than saying test this, test that, use the word should. This is a behavior-driven development trick. Should is very common in BDD circles. You could say must or can or some other variation, but express an outcome. And this is in JUnit 4 and TestNG. If anyone using TestNG? Few people. So TestNG is the same. You've got annotation-based testing, so you can name your tests whatever you want. Take advantage of that and express the action and the outcome in the name of your tests. When you do that, what happens is you end up what we have here. We have a test name that we saw. You give your test name a context. I often start my test name with the word when. That's a habit. I find it easier to express the context, the situation, what is happening, what are we trying to do here. So when you create a cell, so we're talking about this game of life simulation, which involves a grid of cells that evolve over time. They emerge, they pop into life, they die, they stay the same. So here we're writing a very low level test. So this is really, really low level. This is not something the end user would probably see. But it's nevertheless written in functional terms, yeah? So it's written in terms of the behavior, the expectation. What are the features that this bit of code should do? So the name of your test expresses a context, so when you create a cell, and then each of your tests expresses some sort of outcome, some sort of action and outcome. So a dead cell should be printed as a dot, or a dead cell should be represented by a dot. There's a subtle distinction in the code between those two concepts. Now you get a whole lot of tests like that. And they all, in this case, they all have the word should. So I use the word should a lot. Occasionally I'll use the word can, but variations on that. You're expressing some sort of expected outcome, and often an event as well, often an action or event. And you'll see that's an extract from Eclipse. So when you look at Eclipse, you get this hierarchy of behavior and general behavior and detailed behavior of what functionalities you're actually implementing. So at a high level, if you can use this approach for acceptance tests. We're not talking about acceptance tests today, but you can use the same approach at the acceptance test level. This is at the low level, the unit test, but you're using a similar sort of functional-based approach, a behavior-based approach. So your unit tests start to become extremely readable. So if you've got a new developer who comes on and say, hey, we don't want the cell to be represented as a dot anymore. We want it to be represented as a minus. So the developer will go in and look at those tests and understand what the existing behavior is and be able to have a decent go at going into that code and seeing what tests need to be changed. So it's an approach that works extremely well with test-driven development, but the general approach is the same. Just that it ends up working very nicely when you're doing TDD or BDD. But even if you're not, you can use this naming convention to force yourself to think in terms of what your application is supposed to do and not what it does. Because one of the traps with writing unit tests against implemented code is that you are testing what you implemented. And often it works. Often you test correctly that your code does what you did, what you made it do. But does it actually do what it's supposed to do? So I had a recent client case where they had a test that correctly tested the code. Unfortunately, the code didn't do what it was supposed to do. So expressing your test in this term can bring force yourself to think about, hey, what is this actually meant to be doing? And then maybe you'll think, yeah, well, actually, it doesn't really do that. So the quality of your test is really important. I'm a great fan of test coverage, but I would never recommend using it as an absolute metric because test coverage in itself doesn't mean very much. It's the absence of test coverage, which means quite a lot. So if you've got 0% test coverage, you can be fairly sure that there aren't any tests. If you've got 100% test coverage, maybe, maybe not. So go tell an offshore team to give you 100% test coverage. They'll probably give you 100% test coverage, but that will not reflect on the quality of your tests. So you've got to be a little bit wary of that. Oh, I think I'm sidetracking. Sorry. So what I'm getting to is the quality of your test is really, really important. So this naming convention, I've been spending 15 minutes talking about names, so I guess it must be pretty important. The naming convention is really good way of making you think about what your tests are supposed to be testing, and it helps keep your development actually on track. It helps you ensure that your development does what it's supposed to be doing too. So just doing that, the quality of your test is really, really important. We'll talk about that later on. Another tip is to structure your tests in a consistent manner. So here we have a test. What is it? A dead cell with one live neighbor should remain dead in the next generation. So in the game of life, if anyone who hasn't done a coding dojo or something like that, with the game of life, you have a grid of cells, and from one generation to the next generation, you have a set of rules that define whether a cell should be alive in the next generation or not. And so this is one of those rules. The rule is that if you've got a cell that's dead and that it has only one neighbor, it will remain dead in the next generation. So in this particular example, it's a coding dojo, we were representing the grid in a text form. But what I want to point out here is the structure. So the first thing we do is we set up the test, the expectations. So the expectations, what are they? Generally, they're the inputs and the outputs. So inputs and the expected outputs. And then in the middle, we actually do something. So just as a side, when I write my tests, I write usually write the inputs and the outputs first, and then the actual action in the middle. And that forces me to think about what I'm trying to achieve, because how can I write something if I don't know what I'm trying to achieve? How can I write code if I don't know what it's supposed to do? So I always try and write my tests expressing the expected outcome. So this assert that next grid is expected next grid. That's what I'm trying to achieve. And then the input, I express what the initial grid is and the expected next grid. And then I write some code to make it do what it's supposed to do. So that's classic test-driven development. That's not what I necessarily wanted to talk about explicitly. I just wanted to mention that. The point here is that to make your test much clearer, you can express your test in this three-phase notation. You set up your data, do something, then express an expectation. So I keep emphasizing the quality of your test is really important. So you should consider your tests as production code. So the tests aren't throwaway code. The tests should be maintained just like production code. You need to maintain a high quality of code in your tests. They need to be readable. They need to be easy to understand. They need to be easy to maintain. So you have to refactor them. That's okay. Refactor them. If you have to refactor them some more, that's okay. Refactor them some more. So they should be treated with the same respect, if you like, as normal production code. So if you need to maintain your production code, if you need to refactor your production code, you'll refactor it. But tests are the same. So you need to, they are capital. You're investing in these tests. They're what keeps your application safe. Don't let them fall into disrepair don't let them become unmaintainable. So that's what I wanted to talk about with regard to naming. So just the naming and a few tips around naming. If you just take away one thing from this talk, just do that. Rename your tests. Next thing I wanted to talk about is a very cool library for anyone who hasn't come across it called the Humcrest libraries. Now, I've had a long-standing gripe with JUnit. They In my opinion, they got the API wrong from the start and put the parameters around the wrong way. And so you get expressions like this, assert that R equal 10,000 expected tax or calculated tax. So assert that 10,000 is equal to calculated tax. Well, I don't care what 10,000, I know what 10,000 is equal to. It's equal to 10,000. What I'm interested in is what is calculated tax equal to. Yeah? So I always get them the wrong way around and it gives misleading error messages. It's a bit of a general pain. Has anyone come across that pain point? Yep. So wouldn't it be nicer if you could write something like this? So assert that calculated tax is 10,000. Now, it's a subtle thing, but the first test requires more CPU cycles in your brain to understand. And at the end of the day, those CPU cycles clock up and you end up wasting CPU cycles on understanding what the tests are supposed to be doing when you could be doing things like figuring out whether the tests actually do what they're supposed to do. So are you testing the business logic or are you just trying to parse the asserts? So it's really important to have really fluent, readable tests. And an API like Humcrest, where you can say things like, assert that calculated tax is 10,000, that reads very nicely. Makes it very obvious what you're trying to test. It's a little thing, but it's, again, small things that make a huge difference in your practical day-to-day testing. All you have to do is include the Humcrest library, do a static import, and you're away. So Humcrest is all about readability, but it's not just about readability. You also get very nice error messages. So you'll know with JUnit or traditional JUnit asserts, you're lucky if you get an exception. You'll get an exception to, oh, there was an exception. What actually went wrong? Oh, well, I better add some log messages or try and debug the code and put a breakpoint and drill down, and which is a pain because at the point where it throws the exception, JUnit has everything it needs to actually tell you what went wrong. So with Humcrest, it'll tell you something, oh, well, I got this, but I was expecting this. So you get these really readable asserts. So expected is blue, but got red. And that is huge because that means that in the log message, the JUnit error message, you can see, oh, that went wrong. I'll just fix it. It makes a huge turnaround, much faster turnaround than if you have to go, oh, it broke. I wonder why it broke. It's all about feedback. Feedback is king. Feedback is really, really important in this approach, or in all development. Feedback's really important. This is one example. Feedback is really, really key. So Humcrest uses static imports and what it calls matches that you can nest, that you can combine and put together. It's really, really flexible. You can do all sorts of complicated, funky expressions if you want to try and express in one line what you'd need four or five lines to do in normal JUnit. So here, for example, we've got the is one of matcher. So assert that color is one of red, blue, or green. Or has item. Is there an element in a list or has items? Assert, or you can do nice combinations. Assert that color has an item that is any of red, blue, or green. So try doing that in normal JUnit. I mean, writing the loops and the Boolean flags and it gets a little bit painful after a while. And the really cool thing about this, it's quite readable, but when you get an error message, the ERIC message accurately expresses the expression, the Humcrest expression. So it'll tell you what it was trying to match and what it actually got. It'll give a reasonable degree of accuracy. Considering it's doing it all automatically, it's pretty cool. Comes up with a very readable expression. Right here we've got, oh, We were expecting red, green, and blue, and got red, green, blue, and yellow. What's going on there? Oh, it's something to do with the uppercase and lowercase. You see that straight away in the log messages or in the JUnit reports or in Eclipse. You don't have to go and drill down and figure it out later on. Anyone written their own Hamcrest matches? One person. So once you start with Hamcrest, you often come across cases where you'd like to be able to test something. Maybe it's domain specific, maybe it's to do with your application, and the standard matches just don't cut it anymore. You'd like to be able to do stuff yourself. So you can do things like, you can set up your own matches. This is a slightly simplified version of real application test code. I've just simplified the names a little bit so it'll fit on the slide. So what we're doing here, we're actually creating a dedicated matcher. We've got a stakeholder manager class, which does a full text search and returns a list of stakeholders, whatever they are. Doesn't matter. The point is, we're going to do a test. We're going to try and figure out if you do a search on the word health, will it return something containing a stakeholder object with a name called health core? So what we do there, we say we create our own matcher. We'll call our matcher called health core. Fair enough. And what's that matcher? It's a has property matcher. So has property is a matcher, just like any of the other matches we saw, is any of, has item, all that. That's just a standard matcher. And what are we trying to match? We're trying to match that the object, the domain object, has a property called name with a value of health core. So it uses introspection to check out the object and read the fields in the object. So you can use this on your domain objects. It'll work with any normal domain object. And then we just say, assert that stakeholders has an item that's called health core. So we're combining the has item with the matcher that we hand-rolled. So we're effectively doing a has item, but the matching criteria is something we've rolled ourselves, something we've made ourselves based on our own domain model. So that can come in quite useful too. And you can also write your own hand-rolled matches totally from scratch. This is really useful. Often when you're using Hamcrest in big applications, you write your own library of domain-specific matches. So it's not too hard. Imagine we wanted to... There's no such thing as a has-size matcher in Hamcrest, because you can just do list.size is whatever. So there's no has-size, but... wouldn't it be nice if you could test the contents of a collection and the size of it at the same time? So have a signal assert that tests both the contents and the size. So I've got a test here that's proving what we're trying to implement. I want an assert called has size. I want to be able to say assert that items has size 1. This has size matcher doesn't exist. That's what I want to write, okay? So we're going to see how to write that has size matcher. So it uses generics, so it's a bit of a pain, being Java and generics and all that. But you always use the same technique. So you extend this type safe matcher object thingy. And then you provide a couple of things. So you provide a constructor which takes, in this case we're going to use a matcher of integers. So we want to be able to say has size 1, but has size greater than 0, or has size less than 10 or something like that. We want to use matchers as well as just numbers. So we're going to create a matcher that uses matchers. That's what the matcher integer thing is about. We're going to say build a matcher with that uses a matcher itself. And so that'll work with either an integer or a matcher. We'll see some examples later on. Then we implement the matches safely method. The matches safely, so we just basically invoking the matcher that we passed into it and saying, does it work against the collection's size? So no big deal. And then we use this describe to method. You need to implement the describe tool to be able to fit in with Humcrest's ability to write a description of a set of matches. So you write a description of what you're expecting. So we're expecting a size that is a description. So we're matching the descriptor. We're also using the description of the matcher that we're passed. So if we said, has size greater than 10, it would say a collection with a size that is greater than 10. So it's all very recursive, very nested, not too hard to do. Once you've done that, you typically write a factory object, which is the way most of the Humcrest libraries usually work. So you write a factory object. Your factory object will have a method, a static method called hasSize. So that's just like all the standard Humcrest methods. If you look at the Humcrest source code, it looks something like this. And then finally, we can go ahead and use it. So if it fails, so here we've got, if it did fail, it would come up with a collection of size 2, which is not, presumably if we added another item, that's this case, a collection of size 2, but we got Java. So that works quite nicely. But you can also do things like this. Use the same thing combining. So that's what I wanted to do. That was the point of the exercise. So assert that a list of items, assert that our items has size of 1 and has an item called Java. And that gets you out of the issue of what do you do if you need multiple asserts at the end of your test. Normally, in a test, you want to avoid having multiple asserts if you can. Good exercise to try to write your tests with only one assert at the end of each test. Problem with multiple asserts is people tend to start with one or two and then get to 10 and 20. They'll fail on the third one and then you'll keep going until you figure out the five or six other failures that it gets further on. Be nice to have all the information straight away. So here we're getting all the information straight away. So a common use of these custom Humcrest asserts is to write your own matches to avoid having to do multiple asserts. So if you're matching, doing web testing and you're matching against a form, a page displays a certain set of fields, you might set up a Humcrest matcher that accepts an array or a map or something and tests a whole lot of fields. So you can write your own Humcrest matches along those lines.
If the first will fail, will the second will be exercised as well? Or?
Yes. So it'll try both of them. And it'll tell, because in the expression that the expression at the end of the day, it'll say something expecting a list that has size of 1 and has items Java. So it'll tell you what it was expecting and then it'll actually print out what it found. So you can also do things like has size greater than 1. So that's Humcrest matches. They're pretty cool. Who uses parameterized tests? I'll repeat that. Who uses parameterized tests? Oh, a few people. Good. We're going to look at parameterized tests now. They're very useful too. Parameterized tests basically allow you to take a large set of data and run tests against it with one test or a limited number of tests. So you can test large combinations of data using the same tests. The easiest way to show this is with an example. So here we have a out-of-date tax rate table for New Zealand. So just say you wanted to test that. You want to test tax rates. A typical example. How would you normally do it? You'd have a whole lot of tests that test the main ranges and maybe the boundary conditions and the corner cases and edge cases and different. You'd have a whole lot of tests to see if you're getting your expected outcome. Yeah? And those tests get a bit boring. So after the 20th or 30th, you often can't really be bothered adding those extra 50 tests. So, especially that's a very simple case, but if you have a more complicated example, it can become quite hairy. I've worked in insurance companies, and if anyone's done any work in insurance companies, this was with car insurance premiums, where how much you pay basically depends on the colour of your car, the name of your dog, the about 50 criteria. So we had an Excel spreadsheet with about 50 criteria and about 6,000 rows with different values coming out at the end. So try and write 6,000 unit tests by hand. With parameterized tests, you can get away with just one unit test. So the way it works is, first of all, you need some test data. Test data is something that is best provided by someone else. So you get the test data from the testers or the BAs or whoever, or the end user, just so that it comes from a neutral party. But you need a table of test data. And then you write a test, a class that contains fields. You sort of look at this and say, oh, that's a weird sort of test. It's got member variables. So what it actually has is member variables for each column in the table. So we've got a column income and a column expected tax. We've got a constructor which takes income and expected tax and populates the member variables. People keeping up? Okay. And then you write your test. Now, typically, you only have one test. I'll show you an example later on where there are two tests, but often it's quite a limited number of tests because these tests will be applied across the board for all of the data. So every row gets thrown into this test. So then you use run with annotation, say run with parameterized.class. That'll tell JUnit that it's actually a parameterized test. Oh, yeah, have I forgotten something? Might need to actually input the data, yeah? So we need the data as well. So the data comes from a parameters annotation. So you use this parameters annotation, which returns a collection of object arrays. Doesn't matter how it gets the collection of object arrays. All that matters is that it returns one. So here we've got some nasty Java array syntax to generate a collection of object arrays from our set of data. Now, you do this, sometimes you do it this way, sometimes you don't. Sometimes you'll get it from an Excel spreadsheet or a text file or whatever. There are different ways of getting the data. You can get it from different places. But the point is you have a method called whatever you want that's got the parameters annotation, and that returns an array, a collection of object arrays, so effectively a table of data. So that data gets fed into the constructor. JUnit will create as many instances of this class as there are rows in your table, and will invoke the tests on each of them. So when you do that, you run your tests, you run it in Eclipse or however you run your tests, it will come up with a set of results and you can drill down into any errors, and if you're using Humcrest, you'll get a readable error message when you actually go into the details. So that's quite useful. I use that a lot. I'll give you a few examples of the way I use that. Often I don't get data from an inline table. Sometimes I do, but often I don't. often I'll get it from an Excel spreadsheet. So here, that's pretty easy to write your own. Who's used Apache Poi? Yeah, so those have had will know it's not painful but not difficult to write a bit of code to read in data from an Excel spreadsheet. So that's pretty easy to do. I've written an example of how to do that, which is on GitHub. I haven't got the reference here, but if you email me later on, I can send it to you. It's on my blog about how to do that, but it's not a difficult thing to do. Often you customize it a bit yourself anyway because you're getting Excel spreadsheets that come from the business owner and they have funny formats. But the general approach is quite easy to read in an Excel spreadsheet and then pass that back in the form of a collection of object arrays and then run your parameterized tests against it. So I find that a really useful technique. It's also useful because if you get feedback from the end user, you're involving the end user in the actual testing process, which is quite nice. Another approach. So has anyone who has used Selenium 2? A few people. So in Selenium 2 is a web testing framework that you can use to write web tests in JUnit. In Selenium 2, you have the notion of page objects. A page object is a Java class that represents a web page or something in a web page. And in Selenium 2, in WebDriver, you can use these annotations. So typically, here's an example. We've got some annotations that map the fields on your web page to actual fields in your or member variables of your page object. So here we have a field called importer name, and we've got a web element, which is a part of a screen called importer name. We're mapping that, the name is whatever it is. So you do that tip in a big screen, you might have 20 or 30 of these find by annotations. I'm not going to delve into the details of WebDriver because we haven't got time, but just to give you a gist. So the point is we have a page object that has getters and setters, so it looks like just a normal Java bean, but behind the scenes is actually talking to a web page. So in this case, these page objects are going to be used for high-level acceptance tests. This is actually a real example. So you use the page objects for end-user tests, for BDD-style tests, and for developer tests. So these page objects are really important. So it's important to make sure they work. So you want to make sure at least that the getters and setters do their job properly, that you haven't got the name, the find by annotation wrong. So what could you do in a parameterized test? You can do something like this. So what I've got is just an array, collection of object arrays, containing the names of the fields I want to test and an arbitrary value that I want to write to the field and then read back. So I want to just test that I can use the page object to write something to the HTML field, and then when I read it back, I'll get the same value. So it's kind of like a smoke test. It's just making sure that all of my fields are correctly mapped. So maybe you'd want to do more extensive tests later on, but at least it's a good starting point. So we've got our parameterized our parameters annotation. We go and set up some test data. So again, remember, we're reading in the values from the array and injecting them into our objects. So we've got a field and an input value. Then we just write a test. User should be able to write to the input field, then read the value. So this is just we're setting a value using a setter for the field. So that's just using some reflection to go and look up the field in the page object and invoke the setter. The details don't matter, but the point is we've got a table of fields that you're reading into that you're using to test each field on each of the fields on a page object. And just another example of the sort of things you can do with parameterized tests. So they are very flexible. They're not just for calculations. You can do quite a lot of stuff with them. Okay, so JUnit rules. Who's used JUnit rules? Anyone? JUnit rules can come in handy sometimes. So I'll just run through. I think I talk too much as usual, so we're probably going to run out of time, so I'll try and speed things up a bit. I'll just run through some of the more useful rules. The temporary folder rule. Who has ever had to create temporary folders during the tests and then delete them afterwards? So that's a very common requirement. The temporary folder rule lets you do that quite easily. So you use this temporary folder object, and if you invoke that object, you create that object, JUnit will ensure that at the end of the day, it'll get rid of it. It'll create a unique object for each test, a unique folder, and then destroy it at the end of the test. So you create your folder, it'll create a temporary directory somewhere. You do your stuff with it, use it just like a normal file directory, and then you don't have to worry about tidying up or tests getting in the way of each other, because each test will have its individual temporary folder to play with. In order to make that work, all you need to do is to use this rule annotation, temporary folder, and then you've got here, folder, new file, so we're creating a new file in that folder. So use the folder just like a normal Java IO file, basically, file directory. So I find that one pretty useful. A few that can come in handy sometimes is the error collector. So the error collector rule lets you... So imagine you've got a test and lots of things can go wrong and you want to be able to keep track of what goes wrong without just stopping at the first one. So it's sort of the issue of multiple asserts. So JUnit, you can either try and accumulate your asserts altogether or maybe you can use this collector object. So the collector object... This is just a sample test to show how it works. The collector object lets you pass in exceptions. It will accumulate them. You can either just add an error, or you can use a check that statement, which is sort of like a Humcrest assert. It uses the Humcrest assert. So you can either just say add error when something went wrong, or you can do a check. You check that whatever. And at the end of the test, it will accumulate those errors and come up with an error message that actually lists all of everything that went wrong. So that comes in quite handy when you do have genuine cases where it's hard to accumulate the asserts. So rather than doing just, say, you've got to check a big page with lots of things you need to check and you don't want to have to open the page 20 times just to check the 20 fields, you could do something like this. The timeout rule. So the timeout rule is good for general timeout testing. Now, I would not recommend using timeouts ever for fine-tuning performance. It's just too unreliable. But for things like Hibernate configuration, lazy loading, indexing, stuff like that. Anything that can potentially take a very, very long time if something goes drastically wrong. You just want to make sure things don't go drastically wrong. So, okay, every test should take less than 1 second. So normally it should take 20 milliseconds, but if it takes more than 1 second, then something's really drastically wrong. So often if you're testing DAOs or database interaction or stuff like that, you might want to put a general timeout just to make sure you catch any major configuration issues before they actually get into production and start to get embarrassing. That one's useful too. The verifier rule's another one. The verifier lets you add logic to your JUnit test. So you can actually, it's sort of like an assert, but it's something that's injected after each test. So it's something that happens after the test has been completed. So here we're just saying, okay, we've got this system, we've mocked out system error messages, we run our tests, and after each test, we check that no system error messages were thrown. So we're mocking something out. And so that's just an example. But the point is we're injecting behavior to make JUnit add checks after all the normal tests have been finished, all the normal testing code has been finished. The watchman rule. The Watchman rule is a little bit more passive. What it does is monitors your tests. It monitors your tests and lets you inject methods so that you can decide what to do when the tests fail or when they succeed. So typically you might use it for some sort of logging or maybe if you're doing the web test, you might, if Selenium, you can take screen snapshots. You might be writing your own Selenium test framework, and whenever a test fails, you might take a screen snapshot, that sort of thing. So intercepting what happens when a test fails or a test succeeds. So that's JUnit rules. Can come in handy. Next thing I want to talk about very briefly, because it's a very cutting edge, bleeding edge, fallen off the bleeding edge, really, feature, is categories. Now, categories are something to keep your eye on. They're not quite, I don't think they're production ready yet, but once they get proper tool support, they will be. Categories are a quite elegant way of grouping your tests. So in TestNG, you can group your tests with sort of text tags. Categories are the same sort of idea, except you use interfaces. So why would you use interfaces rather than text tags? I suspect one of the main motivations is that it means that you don't get typing errors when you're tagging your tests. So if you, in categories, you define interfaces. So rather than using a bit of text, you create a special interface. You write your own interfaces. So you create your own hierarchy of test groups, basically. So here, for example, we've got performance tests, which extends integration tests. At one point, you might want to run just the performance tests, or another point, you might want to run all the integration tests, which include other things other than performance tests. So to use a category, use the categories annotation. You can either put categories on at the test level, so an individual test can have a category, or you can have a whole class of tests, having all of the tests in that class will have a category. So this is quite a cool concept until you get to how you actually have to run the tests. At the moment, anyone remember test suites? So at the moment, you have to run them with a test suite. You have to basically list the classes that you want to look up. So that's a bit of a pain. There is a workaround, but it involves mucking around with the class path and stuff like that. So that's why I would say this feature is not production ready yet, because you can't just say run all of the classes in this directory with this category. But I'm sure you will be able to soon. That's an obvious feature. Integrating a Maven or Ant task would not be a big deal. I've seen the code. It's not a big deal. You can write it yourself if you have to. But given that, I think it's a really nice feature. And even exclude categories. Parallel tests. Anyone played around with parallel tests? So in JUnit 4.8.1, I think, you can run your tests in parallel. Now, running your tests in parallel works very well if you have lots of CPUs. If you've got I/O as well, if you're doing integration tests or do web testing, you've got to be a little bit careful about running your tests in parallel, because sometimes they may, especially integration tests, they may get in each other's way. Normally, unit tests, by definition, if you've written your unit tests well, that shouldn't be an issue. So running them, who uses Maven? Cool. So it's just running your tests in parallel just needs the Shorefire plugin version 2.5, and it's as simple as adding the parallel tag in the configuration. So you can either tell it to run the methods in parallel, so it'll take just the list of methods. It'll decide how many threads it can safely run in parallel and run the methods in parallel, or you can say classes. So it'll try, which is probably safer, especially with legacy tests. So you run your classes in parallel. In both cases, that can result in quite nice speed improvements, especially if you've got multiple CPUs. So we've almost run out of time, but I think we've got time for a couple more things. Infinitest. Anyone use Infinitest? Infinitest is a very, very cool tool. Used to be open source, now it's sort of semi-open source, semi-commercial sort of thing. The idea of Infinitest is that if you save your code and you've got a compiler error, it will tell you about it, yeah? Eclipse will say, hey, you've got a compiler error. What do you think you're doing? And why shouldn't that work with unit tests as well? If you save your code, you run the unit tests for that code automatically. Wouldn't that be nice? You save your code and it'll say, hey, what do you think you're doing? You just broke this unit test. So that's what Infinitest does. As soon as you save your code, it will figure out what unit tests exercise that code. It will run those unit tests. And it'll come up with an error. It looks like a compiler error, but it's actually the assert that went wrong in the unit test. So it'll say, hey, you just saved your code and it broke this line in this unit test. So again, this is one of those. You can fine-tune it so that it will only run certain unit tests, not all of them. It won't run your integration test, for example, if you want. Once you start using this, it's one of those tools that become that are quite addictive. You never run your unit test manually anymore. You just save your code and see what happens. So that's pretty cool. Last thing I just added last night, who uses Makito? Anyone use Makito? A couple of people? So if you're not using Makito, who uses a mocking framework? Yeah, I asked this question. So if you're using a mocking framework, they are a very good way of making your tests easier to write and cleaner. If you are using a mocking framework and you're not using Makito, have a look at Makito. It can make your tests a lot simpler. So Makito allows you, a lot of it's quite similar to tools like EasyMock, but with less formality. So you can do things like set up we're trying to simulate an account object. So we've got some, maybe we're testing an account services that does stuff with account objects, and we want to see how our account services copes with a particular account object. We don't want to have to read this account object from the database. We want to just pass it in and pretend it's there. So we say, okay, when you call the getFees method on this account object, then return a certain value. So depending on the fee type here, it'll return one value or another. So that's what most mocking frameworks do. The nice thing about Makito is it does it in a very low formality way. There's very little code you have to write to get it to work. So if you use the EasyMock, you'll remember you have to record and replay and do a lot of setting up to get things to work. In Makito, it's much simpler. You can do things like to simulate a DAO. So again, we might have a service class that we're testing, and we don't want to have to connect to the database, so we mock out a DAO object that's just pretending to talk to the database. And we're going to try and test what happens when you pass in the same account number twice when you're trying to create an account. And we know that the account DAO is meant to throw an exception if the account already exists. So we want to simulate that. So we're going to create our mock object. We're going to say, okay, the first time you call create a new account with this number, return a mocked out account object. But the second time, throw an exception. So you can do that sort of thing. Other things you can do, you can use annotations to create mocks, which is quite nice. You can also use matches. It's a little bit like the Humcrest matches. So you can use matches to create quite complicated expressions. So here we're simulating what happens when you call the get earned interest with an integer value that's greater than 2,000. So again, we're simulating the account object, trying to test maybe an account services that calculates the interest across multiple accounts, for example. Or we could do things like verify whether certain methods were called on the account object that we're simulating, that we're mocking out. So was the create new account method called on the account object that we've mocked out? So that's fairly classical, very typical mocking. It's not going to be new to anyone who's done easy mock, but it is very, the nice thing about it is it's very simple and low and lightweight. So it's an easy replacement for easy mock. It makes your test much more lightweight. Okay, so we have approximately minus 20 seconds for questions. We might get away with a few.
You mentioned performance testing. Any advice on how to approach that?
Performance testing is something I generally use tools like JMeter, so as a totally separate activity. So I don't integrate them in the normal unit testing. I do them as a totally separate phase. Okay, thank you.
So what about testing JPA mappings and hybrid mappings and things like that? If you don't want to have to create a bunch of data in a database, is there a good way to do that or like a tool that exists?
What I tend to do is, if I can get away with it, I'll use an in-memory database for testing all that that mapping.
Okay.
Otherwise, the mapping and configuration files, JPA, Hibernate, all that stuff, technically it's integration tests. You need to actually test it against a database. Mm-hmm. So it's everything on the boundary of the system. You do need proper integration testing. It's everything inside you can mock out and use unit testing. So you do need to do it at some stage, but for speed, if you can get away with a in-memory database like Derby or H2 or something like that, you can save a lot of time, make it a lot easier. So it depends on your situation, what database you're using, if there are stored procedures and stuff like that. But
thank you.
Yeah, you kept mentioning EasyMock. Would you be able to give a brief difference between Mockito and JMock? Because that's what we use.
Same sort of thing.
Is there not much difference between JMock then?
It's low formality, so you don't get the record replay that you need to do in and JMock. It's mainly things like that. As far as what it can actually do, there are sort of subtle functionality differences, but it's very, very similar in what you can actually test. It's just that you need less code to test it.
So would you recommend using Mockito in terms of readability over a JMock?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
I have two comments.
Yeah.
I believe Hamcrest does have HasSize now as a 1.2. HasSize. I think you mentioned that it wasn't in Hamcrest.
Oh, yeah. The 1.2 is not available on the central repository yet. That's why.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Another thing, have you ever heard of FestAsserts? It's sort of a nice alternative to Hamcrest.
No, I haven't.
The code completion support is really nice in an IDE. It avoids some of the generic problems that Hamcrest suffers from.
Oh, yeah. That's
this might be worth looking at.
Have a look at that. Thanks. I haven't run tests with Ant in a long time, so probably.
Actually, my team is trying to find a good way to judge whether a test is qualified or not. Mostly, we just judge it by the test coverage. But we eventually find it's not fiery because test coverage can be done in a pretty way or not pretty way. So what's your comments about it? What's the best practice to judge a good unit test?
Other than the magic tool that I haven't come across yet, the best approach that I've found for judging the quality of your tests is to do code reviews and start your code reviews with the tests.
Yep.
So you start with your tests and you get your test. You say, okay, this is a feature we coded. Mm-hmm. Here are the tests that explain how that feature works. If you start doing that, you'll see pretty quickly if the tests accurately describe what the code, and if the tests are readable and explain the features and behavior of your code. That's a good indicator if they're good quality, regardless of code coverage, and if the code coverage will come naturally if that's well done.
Yes.
So you can't use code coverage by itself, unfortunately. You can use it to find out if your tests and if the tests are not testing anything or are not written. But high code coverage is far too easy to fake to be a reliable indicator, unless you really know who the people coding are, like if it's yourself.
Okay.
If you start your code reviews from the tests themselves, that's an easy way to just check that the tests are actually of high quality while you're checking that the code is high quality too.
Yeah.
That'd be my advice.
So think the code review on the test case is more important than generate a report via Coptura or something like this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. That's good if it works. If it works for you, there's things like Clover, which is a commercial tool, which is like Cobertura on steroids, which provides more information on complexity and hotspots and quick fixes and all sorts of fancy stuff like that. But you've really got to be very into metrics and code coverage to get the value that you need to invest in the licenses. So you can play around with it, see if it works better for you. It's quite heavy-handed, though. But heavyweight, but it does a good job too. It's a really good tool. But if Cobertura does the job, use that. I think, like I said, for code coverage, I treat it as an indicator more than a really hard metric. So if the code coverage is low, then there's something going wrong. If the code coverage is high, then you'll need to complete it with other aspects to see if your tests are actually of high quality.
Do you know of any tools that can monitor XX garbage creation? We like changes in the number of objects used to create within a test. For us, object promotion is a really big deal, and that's something we want to keep testing constantly, but can't figure out how to do it.
I don't know any magic tools that do it. I don't any, haven't come across that problem, so sorry.
Do you think private methods should be tested?
No.
Why?
Yes, they should be tested, but they shouldn't be tested explicitly. Your private methods are your class's business. But if you are uncomfortable with the test, your private methods, if you think they are not tested, maybe your private methods are doing too much. Maybe they contain logic that needs to be extracted into a separate class, which would have its own API and should be tested behaviorally separately. But you should be able to sufficiently test a class just by its public front-facing behavior.
Because sometimes it's a lot easier to test the private behavior because you know what is expected. Instead of instantiating a database or whatever.
So if you do it, you might want to look into just mocking stuff out to do that. Yeah. But in that, when I come across that sort of case, I think it's a flag. It raises a flag that I say, hey, maybe my class is doing too much. Maybe that logic that I'm uncomfortable with, I need to pull it out and try and test it separately in an isolated context.
Okay, thanks. So
I have a question.
Yep.
When you have the rule to create a temporary folder, do you have a similar thing to let a temporarily load a set of data into a database for the benchmark testing?
Not in JUnit rules, no. So what's DBUnit can do that.
Okay.
So have a look at DBUnit.
Okay, thank you.